of St. Maximus the Confessor's major work, the Ambigua, will be published by Harvard University Press in April of 2014. He is currently writing a book about the Philokalia and the prayer of the heart. This is what we love to read when it's published. So I welcome, on behalf of all of you, I welcome Father Maximus to be our speaker for the next 3 days. And we are blessed to have him come and visit us. And I hope that, you know, like last year when he spoke in our cathedral in Eagle River and in the Institute, so they loved his teaching. And I was so pleased to hear from Father Mark and from the people about his teaching. And they were so uplifted. So now all of us, please let us stand and welcome with warmly love and welcome Father Maximus.
You must have better eyes than I do, Your Eminence, because I'll be helped if the light is put on. So, there's the culprit. And then it's like this. Okay, thank you. So, I used to have a colleague who would always say that he was very low tech. Thank you so much, yeah. I used to have a colleague who used to say that he was very low tech, and it was only recently that he learned that his AM radio works in the afternoon. So, so whenever I find myself fumbling with microphones and PowerPoint slides and lights and things, I think of that remark. Thank you so much, Your Eminence, for the invitation to be here with you, and I suppose thanks are due to Father Mark, too, for somehow being in the background here, but it's a great honor. This is actually the first time I've been invited to speak outside of the GOA. That's where most of my invitations come from, so it's good to be with you, and I'm looking forward to the next few days. And I ask for your blessing and your prayers so that God may give me the strength to speak to the best of my ability, and also to speak reverently, and as St. Maximus the Confessor says, so that my words will honor the word and not dishonor him. Thanks also to Father Michael Habib, who's not here with us, unfortunately, these days, but he was instrumental in doing a lot of the background work and the emails, and I appreciated his professional demeanor and the timeliness with which he handled everything. And I also would like to thank Father Timothy, who was my first point of contact coming off of the plane in Burbank, and he took care of me from then until now. Before turning to my own remarks, which are relatively brief because you'll be hearing from me something like 6 more times over the next few days, so I didn't want to front load too much now. But before I turn to my own remarks, I just wanted to thank Your Eminence for that extended citation from The Life of the Virgin. It's a remarkable work, extant only in Georgian. There had been a French translation for many years, and most recently a modern Greek translation prepared by the fathers at Burazeri on the Holy Mountain. I don't know if you've been there. They have a wonderful Teskit outside of Karies, and they do a lot of fine work there. They have a very strong chanting tradition as well. So they prepared a modern Greek translation, but most recently, Yale University published an English translation of the Life of the Virgin. So if anybody would like to read it in English, it's now available in that translation. But I was intrigued by the connections, the organic connections between the feast that we're still celebrating of the Presentation, and obviously the Mother of God, but also the crucifixion and the resurrection, which were themes in your talk, largely through the prophecy of Simeon, who at this remarkable moment in the temple says that this child is a sign that will be spoken against and is set for the rising and the fall and rising of many in Israel. And turning to the Theotok, he says, and a sword shall pass through your own soul. And from the very early days of the church, this was taken as a foreshadowing or prophecy of the pain that the Virgin would feel at the foot of the cross. So the pain that she didn't feel in childbirth, she felt at the foot of the cross. So it's a wonderful moment that we're in here with the Feast of the Presentation, looking forward to the crucifixion, and the crucifixion, of course, to the resurrection, and all of those wonderful comments that you shared with us from the life of the Virgin. I think there's also an obvious bridge to the things that I hope to share with you over the next few days, in as much as, just as His Eminence had said, in as much as the Theotokos is very much a type of every Christian soul. I mean, when I see the image of the Theotokos in the Eastern apse of the church, on the one hand, I do see the Mother of God with the child either in her womb, which is what the medallion shape signifies, or holding the child. This is also an image of every Christian soul in whom Christ has been born and in whom Christ has taken his place. And as far as I know, the first ecclesiastical writer to have said this is Gregory of Nyssa in a work called On Virginity, where he says that what took place in the Virgin physically or materially must or will take place in every Christian soul spiritually. So we do have this one-to-one sort of correspondence between the coming to be, the materialization or the actualization of Christ in the womb of the Virgin, and the coming to be or the actualization of Christ in the soul of the believer. And there are actually icons of some saints that also, there's a famous image of Saint Minas in Kastoria, where he's standing in the classic Orans position, and he has a medallion on his chest, and the figure of Christ, I think Emmanuel, is in there. And there are some other saints too that have this. It's rare, but you do see it. And the last, to sort of give this another turn, much after Gregory of Nyssa, Saint Simeon, the new theologian, I mean, who knew the writings of Gregory of Nyssa, says that, yes, there is one Theotokos, there is one human being who has that title in a very unique and unrepeatable way. He said, but all Christians are called on to become Theotoki, which is the Greek Theotokos, Theotoki, that would be the Greek plural of the term, which is, the first time I read that, I found it to be very striking. And, well, St. Simeon, the new theologian, of course, is famous for making very striking kinds of remarks and using very vivid imagery. This is one of them. It's a very bold thing to say, but it's certainly very true and it's very powerful. So I thank you for drawing our attention to those passages, which made me think of some interesting connections to what I hope to cover over the next few days. I have the great honor and privilege to work with young men who are preparing for the priesthood, some of them in the graduate school and some of them in the college. I consider this to be probably the most important thing that I'm called on to do in my life, because what I share with them and what I help them to do will impact on the people that they work with. The life of a priest touches the life of hundreds and thousands of people, so I take this work to be very serious. Of course, they're younger, especially the ones in the college. They're younger guys. I mean, you know, 19, 20, 21 years old, that kind of thing. So they're still learning. They have ideas about things that often aren't correct, and you've got to do some, sometimes you make cognitive adjustments, sometimes you scold, sometimes you try different approaches. But one of the things that I see, it's common, it's a human sort of shortcoming, I suppose. What I see among many of them is that they want to, for example, they want to read a work like the Philokalia. Right? They're anxious, they have this interest in reading advanced spiritual kinds of writings. So they're curious about the Philokalia, they want to read the Philokalia, but yet they haven't yet read the whole of the New Testament, right? So they want to have mystical experiences of God. They pray hard, they go to church, and I think their minds run away with them, or their fantasies or what have you, and they want to have mystical experiences of the most lofty kind that the saints describe before they've undertaken even the most basic kinds of ascetic practices, right? It's like, well, do you fast on Wednesdays and Fridays? And no, because they serve cheese in the cafeteria and I end up eating the cheese. But I'd still like to have those mystical experiences, right? So, well, it's okay. Cheese and mystical experiences aren't necessarily incompatible, but there is a proper and natural order to things, right? So it's a human, impulse. You know, you see the best, you see the greatest, and somehow that's what you want. But we forget that there are other things we need to do before we can rise to that kind of a level. We think we're ready to achieve great things, right? Everybody thinks they're ready for great achievements before we've attended to even little things. Right? The little things somehow seem beneath us. We can't really stoop to them because, well, we're theologians and we're educated and we're seminarians and maybe we've been called by God, and so we can't embarrass ourselves by publicly doing little things. We have to be seen as doing these great big things. But this is, of course, to forget the words of the Lord in the gospel, who says that he who is faithful in a little is faithful in much. And the Greek text is interesting here because the word for in a little, en elahisto, and elahisto is in the singular, en elahisto, to elahiston, right? He who is faithful in one little thing is what it says literally. He who is faithful en elahisto, it's in the dative, in one little thing, is faithful in much. And the Greek here is en polo, which means in many things, right? Which doesn't always come through in the standard English translations. And I take this to mean that the person who is faithful in one little thing, right, will somehow acquire a skill set, if you want to put it that way, will acquire a discipline, right, will acquire a, to use that sort of the scholastic term, the habitus, right, the exis, the Aristotelian term, that kind of, not just a disposition, but a fixed state of character, ethos, right? So faithfulness, devotion, commitment to one little thing, right, will somehow result in faithfulness across a whole spectrum of things, right? And sometimes I think that there are no great things, really. There are just little things. And if we could attend to the little things in life, well, then the great things would follow. And I think, I don't know, maybe the most obvious example of this is something like fasting, because fasting is, well, it's not exactly a little thing, is it? But it's one thing. And if a person could be faithful to fasting, to the discipline of fasting, right? I mean, somewhere St. James talks about the tongue, and if someone could tame the tongue, right? It seems a little thing, but it's this. So if we could acquire discipline over what we eat, what we put into our mouths, right? Which seems a simple thing in a way. If we could acquire that kind of self-discipline, that skill set, let's say, or that, right? Think of the power, in a sense, think of the discipline we would have in other to withstand temptations, right? To not put certain kinds of thoughts in our minds, or not to react to different impulses like anger or lust or pride or things like this, right? So we can't possibly begin to take up the struggle against these greater kinds of sins and difficulties and temptations and all the rest if we haven't been able to do that on the kind of micro level, or in terms of, and I think if you do it on the micro level, if you do it with respect to the small things, well, then you'll find that the big things don't seem so big anymore. The bigger temptations don't seem quite so powerful anymore because you've acquired a sort of a strength of soul or a stability of character or a discipline of character that can be, as I said, applied across a range of experiences or phenomena. Again, to continue with the image, I mean, you might want to play piano like Chopin or Beethoven, and who wouldn't, right? Who wouldn't want to play piano like Chopin or Beethoven? That's a good desire to bring beauty into the world. We heard some beautiful chanting this evening at the Vesper service. I mean, music is a gift from God. Read St. Basil's first homily on the Psalter, which is kind of an introduction to the whole Psalter, and he has a very beautiful and a fairly well-known passage in there on the sort of theological sort of basis of music, which he says is a gift to the church from the Holy Spirit. I won't say more about that now, but it's certainly worth reading. But of course, in order to play like Chopin or Beethoven, you first have to spend a lot of time practicing your scales, right? Just the wish or the desire is not enough, right? You can't just sit down and start playing like a virtuoso because you think you'd like to do that. A lot of hard work and effort. You hear people nowadays talk about genius, and they say there's no such thing as innate genius. It's they've calculated, like everything else today, it's been reduced to a quantity. But they say it's something like 10,000 hours, right? Mastery or even genius in a particular area is no mystery. It's simply hard work, and they've figured it out to something like 10,000 hours, and you can compute that by how many hours a week for how many years or whatever it is. And so, I mean, some people are obviously smarter than others, but I do believe that with 10,000 hours of work, I think anybody can pretty much become a master of just about anything. If we don't practice our scales, so to speak, in the physical world and in the spiritual world, we'll end up in the spiritual world playing the equivalent of something like air guitar. Remember when you were teenagers, how, you know, right? It's not easy to pick up a guitar. I mean, it hurts your fingers at first. You've got to build up calluses, and it's just not easy, and it takes time. And, you know, okay, I don't have time for that, but I'll get in front of the mirror and do the air guitar thing, and it'll, right? So it's a bit of a fantasy, isn't it, right? Or we might think we're wrestling with God. We might think we're wrestling with God, but we're actually really just shadow boxing, right? So we don't want to be players of air guitars, and we don't want to be shadow boxers. We want to be spiritual artists, in a sense. We want to be spiritual musicians and virtuosos, people who aren't simply emanating beautiful music, but people whose lives are beautiful music, in a sense, because of the discipline and the work that we've done. So it's important to do things in their proper order and in their natural order. I mean, that's what the proper is. What is proper is what is natural. And it's important to deal with foundations. It's important to address foundational issues before trying to, when you build a house, you build the foundation before you put the roof on. And like my students, they wanna put the roof up there without having laid the foundations. And of course, that's a very odd kind of plan to have. So to advance this a bit, maybe, and tell you a story, I suppose, that'll help frame things for the next couple of days. There's a wonderful story from the Sayings of the Desert Fathers, which are, I mean, they're really remarkable. I mean, they're so old. They've some of the oldest Christian literature that we have, and they sound so contemporary and so fresh and so modern and so relevant, right? Partly because the whole ethos is so stripped down to the essentials of the desert and the simplicity, but I'm always amazed by just how direct and, again, how contemporary and relevant the Desert Fathers are. This is a story from Abba Pieman, who doesn't get the sort of press, I think, that he deserves, because he's one of the more prominent of the Desert Fathers. And I'd have to check, but I have the feeling that the sayings of Abba Pieman probably take up more space in the Gerondikon, I mean, in these sayings of Apophthegmata and these collections of sayings of Desert Fathers. I have the feeling I could be wrong, but I think Abba Pieman actually occupies the most space in that collection, which says something about his importance in the desert tradition. But there's a great story about him. And apparently a man from one of a nearby city, Elayman, had heard about the reputation of Abipiman. And he wanted to meet the great desert father. So he packs his belongings together and sets out from the city and treks across the desert, goes into the mountains, and finally finds the place where Abipiman lives. Knocks on the door, Abipiman answers and invites him in. They sit down, the abbot brings out, I don't know what, I mean, something to offer him, a glass of water, a cup of water. And right away the man is eager to start talking. He's there because he has important spiritual things that he wants to talk about with Abipiman. And he starts talking right away about the kingdom of heaven. He starts talking about the kingdom of heaven. And the moment that Abipiman hears this, right, he recoils from the fellow and pretty much puts his back to him and just stands there motionless. And the fellow says a few more words and then realizes that something's gone awry and basically just stops and addresses the Abipiman, who doesn't even respond to him. And the fellow's mystified. So he doesn't know what to do. He gets up, collects his belongings, and heads out. Goes back down the mountain and starts to get on the desert roads across the desert, but his thoughts now are at work within him, right? Came all this way to see this fellow, and I expected to be greeted by him, and I came to talk about the kingdom of heaven, and what kind of treatment was that? And he starts working himself up into, and he starts to get a little angry. And he turns around and decides to go back to Abipiman and confront him about what has to go back to the cell. Right? He goes, "You owe me an explanation," he says. "I came all the way across the desert, and I crossed the mountain, and I came here to see you, and I came here to talk to you about the kingdom of heaven. And you turned your back to me. You wouldn't even acknowledge me," right? That was very rude. He goes, "You need to explain yourself to me." And Abipiman looks him straight in the eye, and he says, "Because if you come here wanting to talk about the kingdom of heaven," he said, "I have nothing to say to you." Right? He goes, "But if you come here and you want to talk about the passions, well then sit down right here and open up your heart and I will fill it with every manner of good thing." He says, "Because you want to talk about the kingdom of heaven," he said, "but we need to talk about the passions first, because the passions are the very things that came into our existence when we lost the kingdom of heaven. So how can we talk about the kingdom of heaven if we don't address, right, the real situation, the real state, the real condition that we find ourselves in? You want to talk about the light, but you're filled with darkness, right? And the darkness can't, this is contrary, I suppose, to the prologue in the Gospel of John. This is a kind of darkness that the light can't shine in because it's, well, that's another discussion, I suppose. But the point is that, again, that we want to proceed to the higher mathematics. We want to read philokalias. We want to have mystical experiences. We want to, right? And before we've read the New Testament, or before we've committed ourselves to a basic kind of Christian discipline, or before we've had the courage, let's say, to face the darkness of the passions that all of us carry around with us, before we've had the courage to look at, I mean, the word passions, I think, is problematic because it doesn't really mean much in our language anymore. People have a passion for golf or a passion for, I don't know what, politics, we say. So we hear the word passion, and I think the better word for passion is really addiction, right? Passionate attachments. Passions are attachments, either to physical things, objects, or to ideas and images. Like, I could be passionately attached to my own sense of self, right? Just like I could be passionately attached to food or love, you're a clergyman. No need for me to tell you that there's no limit to the things that people can get hooked on, or the places where people can get stuck, right, in their development. So maybe the better word, it's a hard word, it's a strong word, but it's consistent with the teaching of the fathers with regard to the passions, and it's a word that we know in our language. And so I say the word is addiction. I say the word is addiction. Spirit, it's the spiritual root, in a sense, of all addictions is this impassioned condition that all of us have. So the focus that His Eminence chose for the next few days on the Philokalia, which is really about inner attention, right? It's not about being distracted, it's not about concentrating on things outside of ourselves, but it's about the inward turn, right? Which is to discover the grace of the Holy Spirit within us, grace that has been given us in baptism. That's the point. That's the reason for the inner attention. But when we do withdraw, how can I put it, withdraw our libidinal investment from the world and turn our attention inward again, right? We will find, as there's a famous passage in Isaac the Syrian that I'm sure all of you know, but in addition to finding that deep place within ourselves, within the core of our bodies and within the core of our being, in addition to finding the presence of God, we will also necessarily come into contact with the darker things that we have inside of ourselves. And maybe it's the presence of that darkness that keeps us, that prevents us from looking inward, because it's messy and we don't want to deal with it, and maybe it's been festering there for too long and we're in denial, I don't know what exactly, right? So the focus on the Philokalia, it's not just about saying the Jesus prayer, I mean that's obviously central, but there are other things that come with it, and a big part of that is, I won't say, I mean, certainly seeing the passions or recognizing the passions and struggling with them, but I won't say conquering them, because we can't do that, right? Elder Emilianos, former abbot of Simonovitz, used to say that when you're tied up, which is what being in an impassioned state is, right? Which is what an addiction is. When you're tied up, he says, you can't untie yourself, right? Someone else has to come along and untie those chains or those knots. That, of course, is God. That is the grace of God. But what belongs to us is first to discover the darkness within ourselves, to see it. And it's a very hard thing to see. And I think progress in the life of virtue is not about feeling better and better about yourself or believing that you're becoming more and more virtuous. But the more someone progresses spiritually, the more of their inner darkness God will allow them to see. Because it's a very, very hard thing to see. And God will not let you see it if he knows you can't handle it, right? And that's a crushing, devastating thing to see, right? But it's also humbling, and God gives his grace to the humble, right? That's that acknowledgement of our incapacity, that acknowledgement of our weakness is what attracts the grace of God to us. I mean, there can be no authentic encounter with God, with the holiness of God, that doesn't simultaneously result in a revelation of my own unholiness, right? And for me, the great biblical image for this is Peter. And we're in, I suppose the convent is dedicated to St. Peter, is that correct? Okay, yeah. So we'll definitely share this. I think it's his first encounter with the Lord, and they've completed their work, they're fishing, and they catch little or nothing, and the Lord tells them to go out and try again. And it's funny, just the faith of Peter, right? Peter's almost a symbol of faith. He doesn't say, no, he's a fisherman, he knows his trade. And here comes, a carpenter, right? Carpenter comes along and tells the fisherman, go, he doesn't say, wait a minute now. You have your degree in carpentry, and we're professional fishermen, so mind you, I know. He does it, right? He does it. Well, we're very sensitive about our turf, right? And who can, who are you to tell me and this and that? But here Peter now is a professional fisherman. Goes and casts the nets again, and of course the nets are filled to the breaking, and Peter realizes that whoever this man is, whoever this Jesus is, he's not an ordinary person. There's something about him that, right? He realizes, and what does he do? He turns to Jesus, and the response is, we're used to it because we're used to the gospel story, but it's striking and a surprising response. He falls on his knees before the Lord, and he says, depart from me. Depart from me, O Lord, for I am a sinful man. Right? So there it is. The revelation of the holiness of Jesus, the revelation of the holiness of God is authentic in this context for Peter, because with it comes consciousness, right, awareness of Peter's own unholiness. And it's not, I mean, maybe we should be clear from the start, it's not putting down Peter, it's not making Peter feel less or diminishing him in some way, it's not belittling him, or it's not, well, there's certain language used for this today, it's not coming to me, but it doesn't damage him or traumatize him personally or psychologically. It's a saving wound, we would say, right? It's a compunctive kind of an experience that makes Peter understand, I mean, allows Peter to know who he is, and at the same time reveals the fullness of the presence of Jesus to him. So we will spend some time over the next few days talking about the passions, because that's where we're at. That's what we've got. Having lost the kingdom of heaven, we need to know what these are and be better informed about them. And I'll close with a quotation from St. Maximus the Confessor, who says that, you know, to discourse on the passions, and discourse here, he's always punning on the word logos. So discourse here is logos or logos. He says, to discourse on the passions, for someone to discourse on the passions, is to descend into Hades with the word. So the discourse is the logos. So for someone to offer a logos about the passions is to descend into Hades with the logos, not in order to remain there in Hades, but to break the bonds of the soul's attachments to the world and so rise with the word, right? So that's very consistent with the teaching of Abba Pieman, that we need to descend deeply into a sense, into a discourse about the passions, not to stay there, not to enter the muck heap to take up home there, but so that we might rise from that depth and be resurrected and revitalized with the word of God. So that brings my sort of introductory remarks to a conclusion, and I thank you for your attention. Sort of the MC, or?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. All right, so we have, it's 7:00. We have a little bit of time for any questions, whether it's for Father Maximus or whether it's for Syedna.
It's 8:00. 8:00.